Blog Talk Radio.
Bringing you excellent entertainment from the king of DC media. Here's the Inside Acting Radio Show.
My dear listeners, to another fantastic episode of the Inside Acting Radio Show. I'm your host from the coast of state to the state, a man you can trust, internationally known, nationally recognized, and locally appreciated. It is I, William Powell, the king of DC media himself. Yes, indeed, yes, indeed. Tonight, I will have as my guest Skinny Corleone, CEO and owner of 49th Parallel Productions, and later, Jonathan Tiersten from the classic movie Sleepaway Camp. But first, let's pause for some brief commercial messages. Expect me like you expect Jesus to come back. Actors, it's time to build your brand. Learn what it takes to empower, fortify, and unleash your potential. Visit www.actorsbrand.com/inside acting. Actors Brand is a series of ongoing workshops designed to empower, fortify, and unleash your potential. Visit www.actorsbrand.com/inside acting. Taught by veteran director Pierre Walters, these workshops will help you get the work you need. So visit www.actorsbrand.com/acting. Are you looking for entertainment in the form of a musician, an actor, a composer, a radio DJ, even a Howard Stern impersonator? I want you to check out my man. He's been a guest on the show before, Stuart Brodian. That's Stuart Brodian. Find him at stuartbrodian.webs.com. That's stuartbrodian.webs.com. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And before we go any further, let me tell you that Inside Acting is brought to you by DC Actors Examiners. Please go and subscribe to this fantastic column. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And, by the way, you should be following me on Facebook. My handle is william.t.powell, and my Twitter handle is inside_acting. So I want to go ahead and bring in my man, Skinny Corleone. He's the CEO of 49th Parallel Productions. So let me bring him on in. Hey,
how
Skinny.
How you doing? How you doing, sir? Hey, how you
man,
doing?
Man, I'm fantastic. I'm blessed and highly favored, man.
Right, me too.
Okay, so, man, explain to my listeners what 49th Parallel Bookings and Management is all about.
Yes, 49th Parallel Bookings and Management, it's all about, you know, it's really agency more like, you know, at first I was mainly like a freelance booking agent, but more like I'm putting a label to it now, so it's like an agency. So I represent like a whole dozen, maybe over 12, 14 people right now.
Okay.
At the moment, but it's a brand that like that puts more emphasis on the actors and putting them out there in regards to getting them booked, getting them submitted to gigs and everything, and actually foregoing like the whole negotiation process if needed. You know, so
okay.
That's what it's mainly about. It's about branding and getting the artists out there, because a lot of times, when we're in this area, the DMV area, we don't have representation a lot. You know, some people have had bad raps in regards to management and agencies and stuff like that. And some people who are doing the actual booking, they don't accept agents. You know, they rather take it to the, you know, direct contact with the artist and everything. But
right.
in the real format, the traditional format of the whole scheme of things, they're supposed to mainly go through the agent and manager.
Right, exactly.
You know? So like in this area, we must get used to an agent being able to talk to an agent or negotiate with an agent to book the talent. You know, some people, you know, so I guess they feel as though it's easy, you know, but sometimes, like, you know, artists can get manipulated, so it's best that it is a third party in the middle, negotiate between the two, someone who can talk and, you know, negotiate the whole terms and everything, because a lot of artists don't know how to talk, for one thing. I've learned that, too. They don't know how to speak up for themselves in regards to handling certain aspects of their schedule and stuff like that, you know, negotiating with people who wants to book them. They'd rather just show up, do their job, you know, paid or non-paid, and they get done with the project, get their reel afterwards, and that's it. So.
Absolutely. So speaking of actors speaking up for themselves and making right choices, now what's your take on web series? Do you think web series are a good choice for aspiring actors?
Aspiring actors, yes. And yes and no, because it depends on the level, because a lot of people who are booking or producing web series, they want their web series to be top-notch, top-quality acting. You know, in some ways, though, it's good for the actors because they gain experience and, you know, they can add to their reel. They can begin, you know what I'm saying, build up a fan base. They can feed their fan base. They're already building a fan base, so they can add on to their fan base by promoting it and everything, getting their name out there for themselves. But some, if they're just getting their foot in the door, their first time acting, it's good, but then it's like they shouldn't expect a lead role or anything. So it is good. Yes, I do say it's good, but it's not good for the ones who are not that good at acting. You know, because some people are very, very like they're really just beginning, you know,
right.
and it can, you know, it depends on the quality of the actor. You can turn around, it makes the web series look, it's the quality of it, you know, so sometimes it can be shot good, but poorly acted. But it is a good thing for the actors and everything, so I do agree with that.
Now, you talk about the quality of acting, you know, those that are just starting out, those that have been in the business for a while. What do you look for in an actor?
What I look for in an actor is their work ethic. Their work ethic and their marketability, you know, be that as it may, even though it's all about the skill, you know, skill in regards to acting and everything, I look at their resumes, like when I approach an artist or an artist approach me for representation, I look for their work ethic. in regards to going, being a go-getter, going out there to the audition, because this is an up-and-down business. You can be hot for like a whole week and then be, you'll be cold for like the rest of the month. You know, you won't be getting no gigs, so it's like up-and-down market. So with that said, I need to have people that I represent to know that's what's happening and that they need to have a very, very strong will and being able to take the notes, you know, that's like when they're not getting gigs and not get callbacks. You know, they're going to like 100 auditions, but only one callback or no callback. So they have to have tough skin, work ethic, and, you know, marketability, and to be able to look forward to advancing their already skill set, because if they already have a nice set of skills for acting, they need to still improve, because there's always room for improvement. You're lacking in some sort of way, you know, when you're acting. So be that pulling, like, emotions out, you know, applying your skill set, because some people are just, like, aspiring, but they don't know how to apply a certain technique to where though they need to, like, cry on a dot, on a drop of a dime, you know. So they need to advance in that field, you know, for the people who don't know how to do that. So, yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. Do you think actors should create their own projects?
Create their own projects. Yes. I mean, yeah, I agree. I agree that they do need to, you know, at a certain point they do. Because they're not getting a lot of work and they have, like, the resources to pull together a minor crew or people that do know how to put together a small crew for cameras, lighting, sound, writing, that sort of thing, and they can put together a project. That's good for them, you know. But if some people don't have the connection or resources like that, I don't suggest that they just jump out there and try it, because it's frustrating, because you have to deal with a lot of personalities, a lot of people's schedules and stuff like that. But if you're seasoned and you've been around the block for a while, I recommend that you can go out and do your own thing. It's like in between jobs. Like while you're out there, you know, still acting other people's projects, you can still create your own. But schedule and manage your schedule a lot better than what you usually do. So it is a good thing.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. So let's switch gears to some of your films. The Saki Effect, what's that all about?
Oh, the Saki Effect. The Saki Effect came from Miss Karen Alford. You know, she's a good friend of mine, and she wrote the whole short film. Saki, she's replacing another actor, model, who was replaced, and that's why we have Saki Effect. So it's the same story and everything. We just, the Saki Effect, and it's very, very good. I think it came out well, very well, and it's more like a rich, young celebrity in her morning, in her day, going to a paid event that she's supposed to be attending to. So she's kind of like waiting on her chauffeur to come and get her, but she's taking her time getting ready. And so she's going about her business, having a frustrating day with the phone call about the schedule and everything, about the pay and everything, the terms of the contract. But all the while she's supposed to be getting ready, she's playfully teasing the chauffeur when he gets there to pick her up. So it's like a small scene and everything. It's a small scene, but it's for the young lady who acted it out and everything, her first time is very, very good for her and everything. And it's a good testament to, you know, the writing of Miss Karen Alford.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, they tell me that you're a fan of Sid Field's screenwriting books. What are some of the things you've learned from those books?
I've learned everything. Everything from those books. I was introduced to those books by a guy named Russell Cartwright way back when I was working for the FCC, and he brought those books to me from the library when I was younger. And it's two books, like The Foundation of Screenwriting and The Handbook of Script Writing or something like that. It's two books, and like both of them are like 200-300 some pages long. Had to, you know, I read through both of them, and I mastered the whole concept of how to write a screenplay, full length, because they don't teach you shorts. Those books were published way back in the 80s. As a matter of fact, Sid Field was the first professional writer who wrote and created the first handbooks on teaching the foundations and the fundamentals of script writing. So I learned everything. I learned everything from introducing the first act, the first character in the first ten pages, the plot point ones, plot point twos, the climax, the middle, you know, the confrontation part, everything. I mastered it all because there's a whole lot that goes into script writing because you got to, all the leads and principals have a backstory. And when you're really delving into character writing, you have to create, it's like you're creating a person before you even go down to writing the story. Because all these characters have to be developed. That's the development process when you're developing the backstory of each character. Not so the extras, but the leads mainly, and the principals.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like all those small nuances that goes into their story and how they react to certain things and what they would do in a certain situation of the story is in their personalities goes for the telling of the story. You know, and once you know that, once you know your character, you can most definitely, you know, write your screenplay. Your screenplays are mostly like the minimum, as I learned, is 120 pages. But some people write 80 pages, some people write 90 pages. You know, I wrote 129 pages, but the thing is, when you're writing a screenplay, you write 120 pages. Not knowing me, by my experience, 120 pages may be actually 240 minutes of footage. Because it's double.
Wow.
even though they say that this is what they teach you when you're screenwriting. Each page is a minute.
Right.
But when you're writing, sometimes you're writing paragraphs. You're describing action sometimes, and action is, even though you're writing like maybe a four-line action scene or something like that, maybe seven-line action scene with the dialogue in the middle. If that's on one page, you have like two or three paragraphs or something like that describing action on one page, and that page supposed to be 1 minute. Actually, when you're shooting it in production, it may be 2, 3, 4 minutes. So when you're writing a 120-page script, each page may not be 1 minute. In production, it's
right.
Going to be double that. So that's what I tell people. It's double that. Because when I wrote Urban Survival and I produced Urban Survival, the minutes were 240-some minutes. Why I say it's double that. 120 actually is 240 minutes.
Whoa.
Yes, it is.
That's a miniseries.
Yes, it was.
That's a miniseries right there.
That's a franchise. That's a franchise. That's actually
wow.
A franchise. You know, and some people don't know that. You know, that's why when I say when people come to me about writing scripts and everything, maybe they'd be inspired about what I'm doing or what other people are doing and they want to write. I tell them, you start off with the short films, but if it's going to be a short film, it has to be at least, for my taste anyway, 15 to 30 pages. You know, if it's 15 pages, it's going to equal out to 25-30 minutes. 25-30
right.
minutes of production, of footage. That's what it's because you have to double what you wrote. Each page is a minute, but it's double that when you're producing it in actuality.
Mm.
So if it's 30 pages, look at it to being like 45 to a whole hour of footage. especially like if you're writing a drama. Now, a drama is going to most definitely be double that. Because you're, you know what I'm saying, classes of personality, situation, and everything like that. So, an action that you have to actually, like, really shoot, and you got to edit the stuff together. And after you edit all that stuff together, you don't edit it up, like the footage for one scene, for one page, off of one page. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, you mentioned urban survival. So tell me a little bit more about that.
Urban survival, that was an action-packed, still is an action-packed movie. It's an urban drama, inner-city urban drama. This is my first movie that I had produced, directed, edited, everything. And it is still out now. It is about a group of, you know, street thugs who are actually, you know, drug dealers, and they meet their match in a career criminal crew who actually go around robbing people to, you know, they are career criminals. They call them stick-up boys. They call them stick-up boys. So it's like these are people that don't bother nobody, but they're just making their lives the wrong way. And they're just clashing. You know, bump group of people live by, you know, selling drugs, and another group of people live by taking money from the people who sell drugs. So it's like you have these clash of, situations, a group of people, and then there's a little bit of a backstory where it's a backstabbing that's going on amongst their group and everything. It's like a message within it, too. It's a message within the movie. You know, it's long. As a matter of fact, you know, some people say it's supposed to be 100, like, an hour and 30 minutes. No, my movie, I shot everything. The only thing I didn't shoot was the funeral scene. Mm-hmm. I shot everything. Everything I wrote, I shot. It was, like I said, 120 pages was 200. And 30 minutes, it's like 2 hours and 2 hours and a half. Yes, it was.
Yeah.
It was double.
Absolutely.
It was because mainly when you're dealing with drama and action, it's most definitely going to be double that, triple.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, it's a very, very good good movie. We had a nice little turnout and we got to the premiere and everything. I'm thinking about maybe screening it again. You know,
okay.
We might put like a little double feature together. Me and my partners, Matt Thurman, you know, Emmanuel Goldman and everything. We may probably put something together and screen some shorts, and then also do some feature length screenings of our new movies, coupled with the old one too.
Right. I want to kind of take you down a path here and ask you a question about how you perceive, there's a word that's thrown around out there, the word boss. So in your business, what does that word boss mean to you?
Boss, let me see. My opinion is this, in regards to like someone that actually, you know, calls their own shots, live their own way, and also dictate their own and go about their own future and stuff like that. They're not dictated to by anyone else, and they actually,
right.
They're not falling at the beck and call of someone else. You know, and some people who actually look upon a boss. They're also like a CEO is a boss, like a director can be a boss, you know, a writer can be a boss because they're in the control of something that's like controlling of some sort of a situation or organization or their situation or their company may be a boss in regards to putting things out there for this entertainment industry, for that sort of way, in that definition. But a boss is more like someone who has their situation already under control, and they're not dictated dictated to. Like I saw the what's that? It was Damon Dash. I saw his video.
Yeah.
He was talked about the being the one. He was the only one a lot in the industry that a lot of people are not like him at all. He came in with his own money, and no one was dictating to him at all. So that's probably one of the main reasons why they probably got him out of the game, because he wasn't copulating to anybody else's rules, and everybody else is like either funded by somebody else. You know, they're not going to be able to function or anything unless somebody else dictates to them, because they're waiting on a check for somebody else. You know, he paid
right.
for everything and everything. So, and I respected that when I seen that video. You know, I had to share it like a 50 million times after I seen that. I had to share that on video. So that was good. I was proud of. You know, I didn't know that, because I thought that everybody really, when I see him talk like that, I thought that him and everybody else that was under him and associated with him, that was like really under somebody else's thumb, you know. But he said like, no, he wasn't. All they was giving him was more like distribution, you know. So the big guys, they wasn't his boss at all. It's more like they had to give him a check in regards to paying him their royalties, but he came in with his own money, and I respected that, you know.
Yeah,
so.
that's what's up. That's absolutely how it should work. Absolutely. So what's some advice you would give to some aspiring filmmakers out there?
Aspiring filmmakers, I'll give them either know that this is very, very hard. This is not your, some people who are aspiring, my thing is don't jump in it as a filmmaker if you're not really passionate at it, if you just want a quick buck, you know, because I've been, there is no quick buck in this at all.
Mm-hmm.
No, so there is no quick buck in it, because when I was shooting my movies, it wasn't the amount of people that's out here shooting now, there was nowhere around to be seen. I think it was just only me and two other people who were shooting movies that was out here in the DMV area. It was only me and two other people that I know of on my radar. There was never nobody. All these other people just popping up out of the woodwork. So I say to them and anybody else that's following, like aspiring, they're looking in and they're seeing a lot of stuff that's going on. It looks good, but it's not peaches and cream. Some people will say, they will say to you, it's a hustle. You're hustling to be broke. if people can understand that, it's hard. That's how hard it is. You'll be hustling to be broke. So my thing is, do not get into it unless you're down for the long, hard road, whereas though, you know, shooting movies and it's hard to get distribution. You may not, when you come in, you're not going to even have the resources to get distribution, to get it licensed overseas. You're not going to have that. So if you're not down for the nose in that regard, don't get it in at all, because this is not no quick buck. It's not no, I'm going to get a Netflix deal. Netflix going to pick up my movie and all that, give me $1 million. No, they're not giving that out to no one-timer, first-timer. They're not giving that out at all. So anybody that's thinking that, they're going to be really, really disappointed. You know what I'm saying? Because it's not easy. I'm not trying to dissuade people, you know. You know what I'm saying? Because I know when I was doing it, it was like, when I first came in, the field was wide open. Like, you could run to the touchdown by yourself. Well, I was on the field by myself. Two other people with me. Now the whole field is full. We got 24 players. We got 11 people on each team and 50 teams out there.
Right.
More than 50 teams out there. 11 people on a squad, on each squad, and 50 teams, 100 teams out there, 100 million teams out there on one field. And that's the film industry field. It's overcrowded. So there is no quick buck, you know what I'm saying? But I will say that if you're passionate with that, I will say that if you're passionate about it, if they're well-meaning, if they're for the long haul, they're in it for the long haul and, you know, really dig in, you know what I'm saying, and get their resources right, organize a team, you know. Because I've seen some people that have teams together that's very, very good out here, you know what I'm saying? And I like that. You know, I like that. I can't really persuade people because really the DMV area needs that because just like Atlanta, because I know it's very, very oversaturated in Atlanta, the only thing about Atlanta is they got major press. We need major press. You know, if my movie come out, I need major press. If Antoine Simone movie come out, he needs major press, not just Fox News, not NBC News. We need some major people that got major magazines. They got major cable, even a cable show that's like really supported even on a regional level. We need some press because they got press down there. That's how they blowing up. Not how they blowing up. They blew up. They blew up in the 90s. Atlanta region was rocking way back in the 90s when Babyface was doing it. So they've been doing it. So, but the press, they got press out there. If we don't have press, if we had like, because we can get this, I think a lot of people are doing what they're doing. They have monster success. Some people have more success than others. So there are resources out here. There are resources that's been like networked and brought into the DMV area for area filmmakers. The thing is, press. Distribution, if like, I'm not saying like if one of us make it, all of us going to make it. You know, some people make it. And of course they're not gonna share the resources. You know what I'm saying? Like with my movie Urban Survival, I don't have no major distribution worth for it, but what I do is I have it as a do it yourself distribution. It's not a deal, it's a distribution website where though when it's distributed, it's sold, the money comes directly to the filmmaker. You know?
Okay.
So with that what I did, I've shared that information with others, and when they see that I'm sharing, I'm promoting it, I'm promoting my movie, so they see the link that it's a distribution thing. So there's a guy named Blaze Christensen. He's a black filmmaker out here. He picked up. He saw that it's distribution with that site, so he's distributing Coming from Africa on that website right now. He just released it like maybe a week or two ago. He just released it. He just released it online through the IndieRain.com website. That's a resource for area filmmakers. You can make your own. It's free. And all they do is they just take percent, which is like if it's sold for $10, they're taking $3. There's no upfront fees. There's no taxes or anything. All you have to do is market and promote yourself. And everything that's coming new through that website, what they do is they go market it on their new releases anyway on their website because they want other people to partake in the resource of their website anyway. So IndieRain.com, IndieRain, that's IndieRain, REIGN.com, IndieRain.com.
Uh-huh.
Any filmmakers that's listening to this broadcast, partaking that distribution website. It's for independent filmmakers. Yes, sir.
That's what's up. Okay, so we're getting near the end of the segment. So tell us where we can see your films, man.
I have a website that I'm working on, but mainly right now they can see the trailers on my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/FONZO49 and the IndieRain.com website, IndieRain.com. You can look up Urban Survival. I have another short film on there, but I haven't officially released it yet, and I'm going to probably look into talking to Kern and maybe distribute the Saki Effect on there. But that may be a free website and everything. So we have some stuff coming up, but yeah. Indie Rain on YouTube. You can just look up my name, Skinny Corleone. It's the only name in the universe. So there's nobody have that name but me. That's good.
Okay, Skinny. Well, I learned something tonight, man. I really learned something. I really was just inspired to sit here hear you talk, man. It's definitely going to have you on again in the near future.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate the opportunity too.
That's what's up. That's what's up. Okay, man. Well, I'm going to go on to my next guest. So, man, you have a blessed night, man.
All right, you too, man.
Okay. All right. Be cool. Okay, so we are now going to have a musical interlude, but before we do that, we're going to bring in Jonathan Kirsten, who has been cast in the zombie flick The Undead, of which I'm a proud co-producer, and he is best known for his role as Ricky in Sleepaway Camp, and I'm going to bring him in after a brief musical interlude. Okay, so hold on. Yes, indeed. That was Black Rain by Jonathan Kirsten. And he's not only a great actor, but he's produced a little bit. He does scores for movies. He does a little bit of everything. And I understand he's calling from out there in, I think it's Fort Collins, Colorado. So let me bring him on in. Good evening, Jonathan.
How are you?
Fantastic, fantastic. Thanks for joining me tonight on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Yeah, I understand you're out there in the Rocky Mountain, John Denver country.
I am. You know, I was born in New York City and lived in New Jersey for a long time and then lived in Manhattan. And then came out here to play a gig and the early 90s, and about 6 weeks later, I kind of just gave everything up and went back, and I've never left.
All right. Okay. So, you know, just looking at your career, you've been in the business for a while. You've been in the business for several years. How has the horror film genre changed since you started in the business?
Well, you know, it's funny, you know, to look back on it now after all these years, that, you know, the 80s are really being considered the era of the great slasher. And I think we really did sort of lose something after that. I don't know what happened, but there's been, you know, part and parcels of, you know, decent horror films here and again, but that really was an amazing era for horror films. And now, in modern times, I think you're seeing the best horror films come from the indie circuit. because of the changes in tech.
Absolutely, absolutely. Speaking of which, a project that we're both familiar with, Young Dead, zombie film. Who do you play in that?
I play Matthew, is it Jones? I think it's Jones. And I just finished the script, and it's really awesome. And it's, you know, it's really, it's a classic film where, you know, it's not, you're not trying to, you know, it's no gimmicks, no tricks, nothing. It's just, you know, about life and death and how you handle it and, you know, and characters. And I think that's where the best films like that come from. And so I'm extremely excited to play it. You know, my mom was almost crying because she found out I was playing a good guy. And
I hear that you love playing villains. Why is that?
Well, I don't love playing villains. I think it's actually easier.
Okay.
In respects, because, you know, their dynamic is easier. But somebody asked me in an interview actually yesterday, you know, how will you go about playing a good guy? And I said, people are complicated. I don't care whether you're a good guy or a bad guy. I said, if you think playing a good guy is, you know, harder than playing a bad guy, then you just don't understand what being a good guy is. I heard Cat Williams once. Cat Williams said, you know, all comedy comes from pain, and, you know, whatever comics don't do that are just bullshit comics. So.
Yeah. No. Absolutely.
I would go with
that.
Cat Williams' philosophy of comedy goes to my philosophy of acting, which is if a part of your soul doesn't, you know, bleed into that character, then you're not doing it right. And you know, that's what separates interesting actors from boring actors.
Speaking of parts of your soul, what parts of your soul did you draw into playing Ricky in Sleepaway Camp?
The best and the worst.
Okay.
Gone through so much. My parents have been divorced. It was very messy. My stepmother wrote a book that got published about it. So after, you know, 4 years, it all got rehashed again. There were, you know, terrible feelings of abandonment from my father, who was really more like me than my mother. And it was a very, very difficult thing to come sort of. And I had two older brothers who, you know, kind of excluded me from the whole thing, you know, in the, you know, guise of sort of protecting me. So, you know, Sleepaway Camp to me was like a great catharsis, because Ricky was, he was, you know, fiery and angry, but he understood justice. And to me, I was like, I wanted to be more like Ricky, you know, and not be so scared and terrified all the time. Ricky, you know, bad happened, Ricky acted on it. That was it. No questions asked. Just Ricky went nuts. You know, and Ricky knew what was right, and Ricky knew what was wrong, and Ricky took care of it. Sort of reminded, you know, Ricky, I think I kind of based him on was Sonny Corleone.
Okay.
Father James Caan. That's
absolutely. Fiery character.
Yeah, just, you know, he understood the difference between people who did right things and people who did wrong things. And if you did a wrong thing, Ricky went nuts.
Yeah.
And I love that about him. I've always loved that about him. I learned a lot from him.
You know, oftentimes in fiction, I guess it, we do see characters that do things that we wish we could do, and that's the beauty of fiction. It's what if, and you see that played out.
Yeah, it's the best benefit of being an actor, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So I know that music is who you are. So where can we see your music video, The Princess?
Well, the princess is something we... It was funny. I was in Los Angeles doing the commentary and the documentary for the Sleepaway Camp Blu-ray. And Justin Beam, who is producing the whole thing, said to me, "Do you have a music video?" And I said, "It's funny that you asked, because I was supposed to shoot it right before I came out here, but logistically things didn't work out." And then he gave us a deadline, and we literally had a week to put the whole thing together. And I did it with Groovy TV and a guy named Doug Newville and Mark Haynes Jr., and we went to the Oriental Theater down in Denver. And then we shot, and then we realized Mark realized he didn't have enough footage, and he said, "Can I come to your house?" And so he drove an hour up to Fort Collins, and we shot the rest up here. And it was just a remarkable experience. And so now it's going to be released on the Sleepaway Camp Blu-ray. It's going to be part of the package when it comes out on May 27th.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah, I mean, you can't, like as people say, you can't buy that kind of publicity, right?
No, you can't. That's a real blessing.
Yeah, I'm really, really excited about it. And I've been working on this project with my very dear friend Mitch Desuarte, who actually, just before I called you guys, the reason I was late, I was telling my son that we're going to go see Monster Jam with Mitch and his son. So, which is Monster Trucks, which, you know, the 7-year-old loves.
Oh, of course they do. Now, speaking of music, compare mixing and recording music to acting in a feature film.
Well, there are certain similarities and certain obvious differences. The thing for me with mixing music that makes it, I guess, a little bit more complicated is that I have to get a performance out of myself when I'm doing it. So I'm playing, you know, I'm wearing a bunch of hats. Acting in movies, you know, as you know, I kind of took 20 years off from that or so. And when I got back and did The Perfect House, it was, I used whatever, you know, tricks I could figure out, including a lot of physicality. I work out like a fanatic, so I used a lot of doing push-ups and jogging in place and swinging a sledgehammer and stuff like that to get myself relaxed. And the bottom line is that they're both part of the same thing. When I'm mixing, it's only after a couple hours when I really start to do something that works, because I've gotten all that other sort of white noise out of my head. And with acting, you don't have that luxury, so you need to get rid of it quickly. And you need to be focused, because otherwise no director or casting agent's ever going to hire you again. So I think what the difference is the immediacy.
That's something I've heard a lot of times on this show. I wish I had a nickel every time I heard that. I mean, there's that white noise and that funk, that sort of, I mean, you hear the term said not ready, rocking on go, and it's sort of like, gosh, it's feature film, especially TV, too. It's like, go. You just have to, like,
well,
go.
Especially
so, I mean, yeah.
All those cameras hooked up at the same time, so you're not going to get another shot at it. And, you know, I had I was at my gym class today, which is somewhere between CrossFit and insanity. It's really mad. And this guy says to me, "Man, I didn't get here early enough. I couldn't warm up." And I said, but now you have the fight or flight thing down. I said, you realize that you can just do this. And you can go from zero to go. I said, and I'm not saying that you should do that every time. But as an actor, that's your job. You know, you don't get to do this big warm-up before every scene. You know, we did, as an acting student at NYU, you know, we could do, you know, exercises for an hour and a half and then do a five-minute scene. In reality, that just doesn't work. But you do need to put in the time behind, you know, you need to put in the time, you know, beforehand. Otherwise, if you show up unprepared, then you're just, you know, you're not going to give a great performance.
Well, and you say beforehand, I guess, is this something that's hours before, the night before, or how do you approach it?
Oh, many. I mean, for The Perfect House, I worked for 3 months.
Yeah.
Not just developing the character, but also just figuring out how to get myself relaxed and as centered as I used to be when I, you know, when I play music live or when I, was in acting school. And I actually went back to an Uta Hagen exercise because I had done an after-school special with her. And even though we only had a very brief meeting, she was such an inspiration. And so that was the first thing I looked up, and then I practiced it. And I didn't learn my lines very well. It's another thing I don't really believe in.
When
your lines too well, they're going to seem rote. And, you know, these years of learning, songs by other performers and stuff, it's just I'm so good at picking stuff up very quickly. Like, the director could change the lines that moment, and I'd probably be okay the next take.
Yeah.
But that's all about being relaxed, too.
Absolutely. Yeah, what's some of the things you learned from Uta Hagen?
Oh, man. That intensity should not be confused with mania. And that, being relaxed and sort of being in that moment for everything is something that takes years of study. I think I talked with, I'm spacing his name now, from Children of the Corn. One of my best friends, and I always space his name. Red Hair. Anyway, and we talked about this, and he, has worked on with meditation and stuff, and so have I. And for me, I use exercise sometimes as a method of getting to that point of relaxation. But being centered and being in the moment and being energized has nothing to do with being sort of crazy and over the top. Courtney Gaines, that's what I was trying to think of. But Courtney, has done a lot of study in Buddhism and meditation and stuff. And, to be energized and focused takes the first thing you need to do is relax. But to not confuse relaxation with the way a lot of people look at it. Relaxation means you're aware of all your body. That helps you to sort of focus and listen. And, half of acting is listening. At least half. And reacting. You react to what you hope you have good actors around you, right?
And absolutely.
You react to what, but even when you don't, you can, even use a bad actor. I won't mention what movie I did that, but, I used the bad actor he just pissed me off so much that it made my character even more intense.
Yeah, you use what you can.
I have anything, literally. If you hear a song on the radio, if you hear a conversation, if you hear an argument between the, the first and second AD, whatever, just use it. That's the glory of the whole thing, is that there's, and I mean, that's the glory of, like, life and everything, is that you can use all of it. And, people get bogged down in the mundanity of life, and I'm like, no, it's not mundane, it's intense and interesting. I said, if you're looking at it, from a negative standpoint, well, then I guess it's mundane to you, but, we're all getting older and we're all going to die, and I get that, and I'm perfectly okay with it. But in the meanwhile, smile a little and laugh and but experience the wonder that is, your own emotions, everything. Intense.
Yeah.
And it can really interesting if you portray it. And if somebody is, you know, if you get lucky enough so somebody wants to actually put you on film, especially after you quit a business for 20 years, and they still want to have you on film and do something, well, holy shit, wow.
Yeah.
How great is that?
You
got to
bring it.
Yeah. It's the best feeling in the world. I can't imagine, as a musician, not showing up to one of these acting shoots prepared. I can't imagine.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It would drive, it would make me crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One thing to not know your lines well. It's another thing to not have studied your character.
Got to study your character. Absolutely.
Yeah. And,
absolutely.
You know, they come from the inside out. We don't go to watch, you know, Don Corleone. We go to watch Marlon Brando portraying Don Corleone.
Mm.
That's awesome. And it's my favorite movie, too, so I guess that's why I always bring it up.
A lot of people's favorite movie.
Deservedly so, you know?
Yeah.
His performance is so breathtaking. And my favorite line is, "You could act like a man."
He was a great actor, stage and everything, from Streetcar Named Desire on down.
And I never got to see him
on the waterfront.
Yeah, I heard he was even better on stage.
That's what I've heard too. He's just simply amazing. Simply amazing.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit more about your music, man. So you've done, what's some of the movie soundtracks you've done?
Well, the whole movie thing started in 2000 with, I think it was called, what the heck was the name? I can't remember. It had Ray Wise from, you know, 24 and any number of other TV things. He's a very famous actor. And this guy saw us play. I had taken my band out to L.A., and this guy saw us play, and he said, "Can we put some of your songs in our movie?" And I was like, you know, this was after I'd been out of the business for quite some time. And I was like, oh, yeah, you know, I was still working a day job. And then I think it was about 5 years later that another movie producer out of Denver asked for one of my songs for his movie, which was, like, totally random. And then in 2007, my friend Sean Crouch, who had also, I met him because I had played in L.A. in 2004, and he was writing for the television show Numbers. And they were doing this short film with David Krumholtz from Numbers. And
right, okay.
They asked me if I would score it. And, you know, without any real knowledge of what that entailed, I said, oh, sure. And, you know, the whole film was 7.5 minutes long. And I spent about 25 hours with the first person I was working with. This was before I had a home studio. And the director, and Jason Newdecker was like, no, I hate it. And so then I hired my new guitar player, Adam Schalke, and we put together a piece, and then he ended up loving that. And so that was the first thing I ever scored. And then after that, you know, I vowed, you know, after spending more than 50 hours on a 7.5 minute piece, I was like, man, maybe that's not the career for me. But then people started asking if I would do soundtrack work. And most recently, you know, I did the theme song for The Perfect House and with my cousin Peter Kuberschmid. And then I did two songs for the new Plan 9 remake, which should be out sometime this year. And were two covers of 1956 classic songs. One is the Mickey and Sylvia song, Love is Strange. And then Tiffany Shepis heard that one and said, can we use this for my short, Emmett's for Matchmaker? And I was like, of course. And so, you know, now I guess I see my future path for a lot of this is, you know, to add the soundtrack. I guess would I do a score again? Sure, but I don't see myself preparing to be an actor, especially a lead in a film, and trying to do the score at the same time. That's too much to chew on. And the exciting thing for me is now I'm going to start performing live again, and I really missed that. And so I have a performance scheduled literally at my house on June 20th with the band The Young Ancients, which consists of two members of the Subdudes and Kerry Moore, and who are just such staggeringly amazing musicians, and then me and my buddy Mitch, and we'll see who we put together as a band, but really just amazing. And so, yeah, I mean, I'd like to play, you know, 15, 20 shows a year, if everything works right. But I don't see myself going on any long, drawn-out tours. I mean, I think my focus has sort of shifted to acting and producing.
Gotcha, yeah.
You know, and writing music. I just, you know, I have a family. The idea of being on the road for a long time is not very appealing.
Yeah. Now, I've heard some buzz up there that... Oh, you had something else?
I said, and I live in paradise, so it's, you know, it's like, why would I want to leave? It's just phenomenal.
Yeah, paradise.
Yeah, Fort Collins, Colorado is so beautiful, and I live on an acre, and that's why we're having the concert in my backyard, and so it's just going to be amazing.
You have a good view of the Rockies?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we see what is called the symbol of Fort Collins, which is Horse Tooth Rock, which looks like an upside-down horse's tooth. My son can see it from his bedroom, and you can see it from my backyard, and you can also see Long's Peak, the 14,000-foot peak, but it's pretty great.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place to live. You know, John Ashton, who played Taggart in Beverly Hills Cop, he lives here too. And you know, it's you know, so if you have to travel to, you know, L.A., you know, and that's fine. And also, but if you know, if I lose a little work because I'm here, that's okay.
Yeah, you got your priorities straight. That's what all that matters.
Yeah, no, and it's a really, I always say to anybody who I do an interview with, I'm like, our house is an open door. You want to come visit, you come visit and you stay. it's sleep here. It's all fine. You can pitch a tent in the backyard.
Sounds like fun.
It really is.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, there's some buzz out there that you're not a big fan of awards. I've heard that. Like for example, what would you have against, like, the Oscars and the Grammys?
I don't have anything against them, per se. I don't have anything against them. I'm just not particularly interested in them.
Okay.
I grew up as a really huge Woody Allen fan. Which is why some of the more recent stuff has really driven me nuts. but I just, you know, and I know he never showed up. I know Brando never showed up. I've always thought awards for art were fairly confusing. And I mean, I have friends who will argue against me for this, you know, till they're blue in the face. And I said, you're missing my point. My point is I don't want to argue with you at all. I'm not telling you that you enjoying this or liking it is a bad thing. I don't care. I am telling you that if I were ever nominated, I wouldn't be there. And they always say, why is that? And I said, because I'm sure I have something better to do. And I would make a point to have something better to do at that point. But I don't even like being around people in the business for any reason other than when we're working.
Huh.
One of the reasons I quit the business in the first place was because I hated the way people talked about it. I didn't like being around musicians either. It's that weird dichotomy between the art you're creating and the business of the art.
Okay.
And I was always terribly uncomfortable with that, and I became a terrible pariah in the Denver music scene. Oh, yeah. And, you know, because they were like, he thinks he's better than the rest of us. And I was like, I don't think I'm better than you. I don't like being around you. There's a huge...
Okay.
And you're telling me that there's this local community of musicians that are all supporting each other, and I'm telling you, you're lying. Because you're all stabbing each other in the back at every chance you get, and everything you do is a load of crap when it comes to, I love their music, oh my God, I love them, you know, and then you talk to that same person in private, and they go, God, he just sucks, and I just got to a point where I was like, wow, this is a lot like what being in the acting world in New York was, and I realized that I was trying to, when I split the whole scene, I was trying to find what mattered to me, and it was really small things, you know, being able to just be honest with the people who are close to you. It took me a long time to get there. Holy shit, man, long time, because there were a lot of dark, stupid years there. And, you know, years where I was like, I don't understand why I'm not getting the adulation that I feel like I deserve. Not for Sleepaway Camp, which I would deny I was even in, but for my music.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And that is true. I actually used to deny I was in Sleepaway Camp. I would lie about it. You can ask Felissa about that. She thinks it's funny. She's like, man, you're so intense.
Yeah.
Well, but she said that, you know, my major in college was brooding. And she said it's a great irony because now you're, you know, very positive person, and I really am, but I wasn't for many years. But I, as far as getting back to the point, the award shows, no, I just have no interest at all. Just the little thing seems silly.
Yeah, because I know you won an award for your film, The Perfect House. I mean, did that make you feel strongly one way or the other?
Well, yeah, I guess I was flattered.
Okay.
But the difference between The Perfect House and Return to Sleepaway Camp was that I knew, you know, if the director, Chris Hulbert, picked the right shots, that I did a great performance, and so I trusted in him, and thankfully he did, to pick the right takes, and you know, also that the cinematographer shot them so brilliantly, because, you know, obviously there's some terrible clunker takes in there as well, I guess I was I had mixed feelings about winning the award. And, you know, even though I've used it in my resume, which is, you know, great hypocrisy, but I had mixed feelings about it because, you know, I mean, the question is, you know, you know what made me feel better than the awards? I think this is a better explanation.
Uh-huh.
A girl said to me, I think it was 2 days ago, she said, "You're so damn creepy, and I wanted to hate you, but you're so hot." She said, so the creepy hot guy, she said, that is the worst villain ever. I said, that is the best description I've ever heard, because never, ever would a reviewer admit that that was the allure of a character. You know, that... And the funniest thing was the way I played John Doe. He was, I mean, it's hotness aside, I have no idea, but I wanted him to be somebody that people could understand. Because everybody kept asking me, how do you play somebody that mean? I was like, it's easy. I said, to play them to the point where they are interesting and make you want to keep watching them, I said, that's not interesting. I mean, that's not easy. Mm. That's hard. I said, that takes, you got to give the character charisma. You got to give the character a backstory.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's why Freddy Krueger works, you know? That's why, you know, there's not a lot of great, you know, scary guys that, you know, that's why Anthony Perkins was so good. Because he felt sorry for him, you know? Whereas John Doe, was totally different. You didn't feel sorry for him. And, you know, everybody said, oh, you were kind of like Dexter. And I was like, no, much more real and much meaner than Dexter. Because you know, the whole Dexter thing takes a real leap of faith to be able to, you know, accept it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, they talk about him being a psychopath, and yet he obviously experiences deep emotions, whereas John Doe does not. I would love to, delve deeper into John Doe because I already have an idea of where he would end up, but, you know, we'll see.
Interesting. Now, the story goes that you did a commercial with Gabe Kaplan from Welcome Back, Carter, and he reportedly said that you were a natural. So, I mean, what qualities do you think a natural has?
You know, I would go to Derek Jacobi, the great British actor and director. There is a... It's a combination of two things, I think. One is, you know, just whatever DNA and charisma was built into your DNA.
Uh-huh.
Obviously. And the other is the desperate need to either make people laugh or please them. And it's a terrible burden, but it's there. And so Gabe understands that, and I understand that, and I even understood it then. It's like this, you have to have these tiny little victories of making people laugh and making people smile all the time. Otherwise, your life is just not fulfilled. And you're just desperate to do it all the damn time, and you can't stop doing it. And it's not something you do like, how do I put it? It's not something where you're like, oh my God, I really want to make this person laugh. It's just innately who you are. And so every painful situation for you, you want to end in laughter and smile. Mm-hmm. And I think that goes to what comedy is. I mean, I think if I weren't a musician, I would have become a stand-up. Because I can't imagine what else I would have done. I mean, I had real problems. I hated them. And what made me even more angry was that I was good at them, because I was raised with that, you know, sort of Judeo-Christian sensibility of, you know, you've got to do this and you've got to do that, and then you got to have a child and but for me, I think that part of being a natural is that it means so much to you to make people laugh, and because of that, you hone that skill. Mm-hmm. And that's why, because I made Gabe laugh. And And, you know, to make a comedian laugh is not the easiest thing. And I'll tell you, his sort of viewpoint of most of the kids in my high school,
yeah,
who were all trying to, like, show off and stuff, there was a total difference, you know. I wasn't showing off. I was, you know, I was being me, and he thought that was funny.
Yeah.
And, you know, these other kids, you know, that they were either crippled by his fame, which he was pretty famous at that point, or they were trying too hard. That's a huge difference. And it, you know, you think it's a skill, and I think more than a skill, it's almost a need. It just was,
yeah.
It was and it is who I am. And it's funny because my son totally inherited it. I mean, he, you know, got on his report card yesterday from his music teacher, who I can't stand, and call her the pinched vagina. That she put, and she didn't even write it in a complete sentence, but she wrote, talking disrupts others. And I was like, well, how about you find out if he's really a good musician, you idiot? But that's what she's doing, what she's doing. But, and that doesn't mean that other teachers who teach music to, you know, second graders aren't great musicians, because I'm sure there are, but he just isn't one. And so I just, you know, I was laughing when I read his report card, and then I read it to my wife, and she goes, I can't stand that woman. I said,
oh wow, yeah, that's a great answer. That's a really well, I've never heard it explained that way.
Well, it's just, you know, she thinks that, you know, like, listening and paying attention and being obedient defines, you know, how you're going to get through music class. What the hell are you talking about? No creativity.
Wow.
Like, if you can't how to channel his energies, he's not having problems in any other courses like science and social studies and math and English. I was like, but you're having problems in music? I said, that's because you're too pinched. And their musical programs are like this, you know, like this testament to political correctness. It's just annoying.
Yeah.
The last one we sat through, we were just like, and, you know, because in kindergarten it was cute. In first grade we were like, and then second grade we were like, shouldn't she be challenging them a little more? You know, like, shouldn't some of the kids be singing solos or something?
Right.
You know, we reached this point where it's just everybody is equal all the time. So she's not even going to try and find out if any of these kids are exceptional. And I don't even care if it's my kid, you know, just, I'm sure there's kids in there who are exceptional.
Exactly.
But we don't do
exactly
that. We don't like it. You know, when, you know, we do it for sports. Oh God, do we do it for sports? You know, our political correctness, you know, reaches only a certain level. It's like, it, you know, they're politically correct when the kids are 5 or 6 or 7 in sports, and then that goes right out the window. You know, the recruiters are coming in when they're 10 or 11 or 12, so. But I just think it's, you know, the idea is at some point you have to determine what strengths and weaknesses. It's not to leave certain kids behind, but I think your job as a teacher is to determine strengths and weaknesses.
See what they're good at. See what they're good at. You know, they all have different levels. I know my daughter is self-taught in piano, and she's also an accomplished violinist. And,
I love it.
You know,
that's
like amazing what they can do. You don't know they can do all that. You know, it's amazing.
Oh, that's a bizarre. How old is she?
She'll be 14 in May.
Oh, my gosh. What day in May?
What's that now?
What day in May?
Oh, the 25th.
Oh, yeah, because my son's May 9th. But, I mean, violin, I mean, to even be able to play well enough so it doesn't sound like you're strangling, you know, a chicken is miraculous. I mean, it's such a brutally difficult instrument. My father plays concert bassoon, sort of similar.
Uh-huh.
So you let your kids figure out what they want to do, and then, you know, you try and guide them a little bit because, you know, sometimes they need a little extra motivation to not let things go. So they don't spend their lives regretting something that they should have done or could have done.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Block is, right, Bill?
Yeah. I tell on myself a little bit. I took piano lessons up until about 13. I guess for some reason I didn't like it. I was okay at it, but I don't know. Maybe I wasn't had the skill, but not necessarily the will. So you got to have the will, too. That's the other part of it, too.
Again, I'll go with what Derek Jacobi said about acting. He said, it has to be a need to. It can't be a want to. And it's the same thing with music. And he says, because nobody would live this life if they had the choice. He said, I'm talking from the perspective of someone who's quote-unquote successful.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's awful. He said, and I always tell my wife, I'm like, you know, rejection and disappointment is my job description.
Yeah.
When I was 35.
Good. Because it's so subjective.
When I was 35 years old, that's why I don't like award shows. When I was 35 years old, the CEO of the company that I was working retail for said to me, because they were offering me these promotions and I kept turning them down, he said, what makes you think you can do anything other than this?
Hmm.
Great motivator.
Hmm.
You know, whether he knows it or not, it helped.
Yeah.
You know, working 50 hours a week at my retail job and, you know, playing gigs wherever I could on the weekends and then using my vacation time to tour. And I don't have any regrets or any anger or anything. Happy.
Yeah. Huh. Hmm.
Came out the other end, and now all these fun things are happening, so.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And my son gets
a lot. We're getting down to about 8 minutes to go, so I want you to, there's so much I could ask you, but I was going to have you get into, like, advice for actors, but I think we've tread that ground. Talk briefly about your film Redemption, what that was all about, and how fans can keep up with you.
Well, Redemption was a really amazing project. I don't have what would be considered a large role in it, but I got to work up with George Loros who played Buffalo Ray Curto on The Sopranos, and he knew Brando, had worked with him, and everybody on Redemption was a method actor from either the Actors Studio or the Strasberg Institute or New York University, which is where I went to school. And, so really intense, amazing, meeting Barry Primus, another contemporary of De Niro, and Barry did, he actually wrote and directed a movie that De Niro was in, and then I stayed on after I had done my part. I stayed on as crew.
Uh-huh.
Just sort of to immerse myself in the experience. And the film is a project by a guy who's an acting teacher at NYU called named Timothy Martin Krause, and I'm very, very excited. They're just about to start hitting the festival circuit, and I had such juicy, wonderful scenes, and I got to do a scene opposite George Loros, but then I also got to do a big chase scene and a fight with a fight coordinator in the whole nine yards with Tim, and it was just a wonderful experience. It really was. And I'm, it took a long time for it to come out, but I'm I'm really, really, really excited to see what the final product looks like, because I know Tim is, like, such a perfectionist. He's, like, he's crazy perfectionist, so I'm sure it's going to look phenomenal. And you know, George was amazing. And as far as getting in touch with me, it's pretty easy. You can do JonathanTiersten.com, which is not all that complicated, which is my website, and I do actually, and I run it myself, so if somebody gets in touch from there, then I will immediately get in touch back. There is also my fan page on Facebook, which is Jonathan Tiersten and 10 Tears, which is my nom de plume, which is my last name syllabically reversed. And my regular Facebook page, which, you know, if you're willing to listen to my philosophical rants and political rants, then you're more than welcome to come on. Beyond that, I guess I'm on, what am I on, Pinterest, I'm on Twitter. I just joined Twitter, like, I don't know, 3-4 months ago, and I already have, I think, 1,100 followers, which is fun. And the most, my most favorite follower to date is from yesterday, which was Lauren Ashley Carter, who played the lead in Jug Face, which is okay. A movie that my friend Ron Oliver, who is a great director, bought for me on my birthday, because my wife and son were in Iowa on my birthday, and he was like, "You're alone on your birthday?" And so he bought me this movie, and I watched it, and it's a really great movie. And she got in touch with me. Well, I don't remember. I think I got in touch with her first on Twitter, but then she got back in touch with me and said, "I don't know if you know this or not, but you're kind of a big deal to me." And then she put hashtag sleepaway camp. And I was like, all right, this is crazy. So I talked with Mark Del Negro about, you know, maybe trying to cast her in something. If we can afford her, but we'll see. But that was really cool, because I was just like, I was so impressed with her performance. And, you know, she's a young kid, and she was so good in that movie. And they won speaking of awards, they won a ton. But, and she's very hot right now. But it was so crazy to hear her say, "You're kind of a big deal to me." And then she said, "Ask the actor of my last."
Yeah.
I was kind of, you know, excited by that. But, you know, and then as far as my music, obviously, you know, iTunes, Reverb Nation, YouTube, the whole nine yards. I don't care whether you buy it or whatever. I just want you to listen to it.
Well, Jonathan, it was fantastic. I really learned a lot tonight. It was more than an interview. I think it was a conversation. I think we had a very in-depth conversation.
I will relate this to you. That's exactly what George Lauro said acting is. He said, all these people, when we were on Redemption, he goes, they're just acting. He said, you and I had a conversation.
Yeah.
So that's a great interview. It's like good acting.
Yeah.
That's the way to have a conversation.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate it, because this was fun.
Oh, you're welcome. Yes. Okay, well, you have a blessed night and a blessed week.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. All right. Good night. And I want to leave my listeners with this thought: to do something for your career every day and break a leg. Good night.